Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service, presents for our blind and print-impaired listeners, Indie Week. This issue, dated January 29th of 2020, read by John Federson. And let's remember to thank our wonderful volunteer musical ensemble for our theme music. Today it's the Katzenjammer duo, Hans und Fritz. They're formerly known as the Elbonian Philharmonic. Thank you, men. We'll see you in 56 minutes. Coincidentally, this issue of Indie Week is the local beer issue. So off they go to see about it. And I was not funning you. The cover says, the local beer issue. May God have mercy on our livers. 48 breweries, 9 writers, 1 mission. Drink our way through the Triangle's best beers. And I will see, after I've read the regular articles, how many of those places I can bring to your esteemed attention. So let's get at it. Our opening voices column from Courtney Napier, who is a Raleigh native community activist and co-host of a podcast, Mothering on the Margins, Whitewashing Raleigh's Future, she writes. On New Year's Day, I had the pleasure of meeting with the legendary Professor Linda Dallas, an accomplished painter and illustrator who teaches in the art department of St. Augustine's University. We sat at the Starbucks on Peace Street and discussed how our city has grown and changed over the years at an ever-dizzying pace. As we talked about the transplants to Raleigh, she said something profound. Many of the 60-plus people moving to the area are moving away from the very cities that Raleigh is trying to emulate. And many of those who are moving are people of color. Immediately, I knew this needed to be written about, this whitewashing of the future of Raleigh by our politicians and our media. Nearly 30% of Raleigh's population is black. And along with every other minority group, it has grown since 2000. Experts estimate that people of color will be the majority of Raleigh's population by as early as 2025. But reading articles like those in the Indies 2040 Vision series would have you believe that black and Latinx leaders will not exist 20 years from now, at least not any worthy of their own column. Out of the 13 contributors tackling topics like the future of housing, politics, art, and the robot apocalypse, not counting the sections on the future of the Triangle's municipalities, which had multiple authors, there was only one person of color represented. Shout out to the realist Zainab Belloc. Black culture was mentioned in the piece about hip-hop being a future subject of arts education, but it was written by a white man. Similarly, the News and Observer recognized former DHIC Executive Director Greg Warren as its 2019 Tar Heel of the Year, but left out the fact that DHIC was founded by Raleigh's first and only black mayor, Clarence Lightner, in 1974. It seems we didn't exist as leaders in the past, either. When you look at City Hall, the future is just as pale. Conversations about affordable housing are mostly referring to blue-collar workforce housing, meaning Raleigh's teachers, first responders, and government workers, professions where there is a gross underrepresentation of black and brown people. And what about minimum wage workers, single parents, and those on a fixed income? The city council and its staff have said multiple times that they're not focused on providing housing for residents who make 30% of the area median income or less. Raleigh developers are looking to build houses for the young singles, couples, and families moving to the area for tech industry jobs, a sector of the market that is predominantly white. But this group comprises a dwindling percentage of Raleigh's actual projected population. Why is this happening? The whitewashing and rich washing of Raleigh's future? Why are our government and media ignoring the proverbial writing on the wall? I can't speak to the intent of these entities, but the effect is that Raleigh's black community is being ignored, and they know it. Their needs are being swept under the rug, and they know it. Their knowledge, voices, and perspectives are being shut out, and they know it. Our city and county are full of black people with fascinating and insightful perspective on every topic covered in that Vision 2040 series. Elia Blaylock, creator of the Black Raleigh Facebook page, would have incredible insight regarding the future of media. There are two HBCUs in downtown Raleigh, historically black colleges and universities, with professors and students who could share important perspectives on the future of education. Wanda Coker has been on the front lines of the fight for fair and affordable housing and deserves a column of all her own. Mike Williams, creator of the Black on Black Project, is an authority on the Triangle's art scene and has a clear vision of its future that ought to be heard far and wide. There were some brilliant minds represented in the 2040 Vision series, as there are in City Hall, but they do not accurately represent the diversity of Raleigh or Wake County. The great science fiction novelist Octavia Butler said, "Whites represent themselves, and that's plenty. Share the burden. Black people exist in Raleigh's future, and the future is now." And here's a selection for The Good, the Bad, and the Awful, this week's issue. Good, Ashley Kennedy. The president of the McDougal Terrace Residence Council was tired of living in a hotel room and subsisting off of mac and cheese cups, so last Tuesday she made her presence known at the Durham City Council. "If I have to disrupt every city function, every county function, I want it, because if they disrupt our lives, we're about to disrupt theirs." 2 days later, she and other MAC residents disrupted a council work session. On Friday, despite death threats, she appeared with council member Jillian Johnson and Bernie Sanders campaign co-chair Nina Turner at a town hall in East Durham, where she said she plans to run for city council and demanded the recall of the DHA board and executive director Anthony Scott. Through her activism, Kennedy is making sure that no one forgets the MAC's residents as the crisis recedes from the headlines. Not today, not next month, not next year. And for the bad, we have Senator Tom Tillis. There are probably senators who have acquitted themselves just as poorly during Trump's impeachment, but they don't represent North Carolina, and so we're once again going to talk about Senator Tom Tillis, a human squid hybrid who has somehow survived 59 years on Earth without a backbone. Tillis, who's been diligently kissing Trump's derriere ever since his national border emergency flip-flop last year, long ago declared Trump's innocence. But on Sunday night, the news about John Bolton's book and the claim that Trump told him he was linking the Ukrainian aid to a Biden investigation gave Tillis another chance to show a smidge of moral courage. He was a bona fide conservative, refuting the president's chief defense. Who wouldn't want to learn more? Well, Tom Tillis. By Monday morning, he'd reiterated his position. "Nothing to see here. Move along." And the awful. Dennis Nelson, 71, a gun shop owner in Johnston County, is running in the Republican primary for state senate. He is also accused of domestic violence, but that's just the beginning. As Carolina Public Press reported, Nielsen allegedly told one of his primary opponents that she's not qualified to hold office because she's a woman. Nielsen denies that. And according to records Nielsen provided to the Wilson Times, he believed, quote, "The paperwork is proof that any woman can say whatever she wants and officials will automatically believe her," the paper reported. His wife's application for a restraining order accused him of taking her cell phone and keys, preventing her from working, bullying her disabled son, tracking her movements with electronic devices, physically assaulting her, and threatening to file criminal charges against her unless she had sex with him. He also gave her an 8-page document on, quote, "how to be a submissive wife." Side note, Nielsen refused to discuss the domestic violence allegations with a lady reporter from the Times, so the paper reassigned the story to a man, which is bull. If elected, Nielsen told the Times, he wants to make it harder for women to file Me Too-type allegations. Of course he does. And here we go with the news columns. Tomasi McDonald from Durham. There's no money. Across the country, underfunded, public housing agencies need $70 billion for repairs they can't afford. McDougal's Terrace is not an anomaly. After McDougal residents were displaced in early January, Durham Housing Authority Executive Director Anthony Scott blamed decades of failed federal policy for the issues plaguing the city's oldest public housing complex. From the beginning, Scott told the Indy last week, public housing was designed to be uncomfortable so that residents would want to move out. But in Durham, quote, that didn't work for black folk who had limited places to go. White folk could get on their feet and move out. Black folk faced restrictive covenants and redlining so they couldn't get housing loans, end quote. Over the years, public housing was chronically underfunded and housing complexes became hives of crime and poverty. They were viewed as something separate from the rest of their communities and left to decay. No one lives at McDougal Terrace or any place like it by choice, Scott says, pointing out the city's average public housing resident earns less than $10,000 a year. The situation has only become more tenuous under the Trump administration. Every one of the president's budget proposals has sought drastic cuts to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the agency that funds public housing. His most recent budget called for eliminating the Public Housing Capital Fund, which goes toward the upkeep and maintenance of communities like McDougal Terrace, and cutting the Public Housing Operating Fund by 38%. Public housing's allocation, Scott says, is less than what it should be. It's been going on for years. Housing authorities have pushed back time after time for more capital funds. As with most presidents, Congress hasn't taken Trump's budget as gospel, especially after Democrats took the House and Representative David Price, who represents parts of the Triangle, became chairman of the Subcommittee on Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development. On December 20th, Trump signed a funding bill that included more public housing money than his administration asked for. On January 3rd, DHA began relocating those 280 McDougal Terrace households to area hotels after inspection discovered dangerously elevated carbon monoxide levels from gas stoves, furnaces, and water heaters. Parenthetically, from November to January 1, three infants died at the MAC. Their causes of death are unknown, although the state medical examiner ruled out carbon monoxide. With the media's attention focused on the complex, residents also pointed out a host of other long-standing but unaddressed issues, including lead paint, mold, sewage problems, crime, bed bugs, and roaches. Last week, tensions boiled over. Led by Residents' Council President Ashley Kennedy, about 50 MAC tenants disrupted a Durham City Council meeting on Tuesday and then another on Thursday. Kennedy has called for Scott's removal and the resignation of the DHA board. I understand the anger and frustration, Scott says. I understand that it comes to me, but I also want them to understand that it's bigger than the Durham Housing Authority, too. What's happening at the MAC parallels the public health challenges facing public housing communities across the United States, says David Weber, a policy analyst with the Public Housing Authority's Directors Association, whose members represent 3,200 housing authorities nationwide. Weber says there are many, many, many public housing communities facing these problems. New York City in recent years, Wellston, Missouri, Cairo, Illinois, where there have been deaths due to carbon monoxide, Weber says. Aside from addressing these crises, however, federal officials have squelched funds for the kind of normal repairs that any homeowner would do on aging properties, Weber says, things like roofs, furnaces, windows, and plumbing and electrical work. The situation in Durham underscores the result of years of underfunding public housing, Price told the Indy. These hazards arise as a function of poor maintenance. The need is great. Public housing in general really needs to be more generously funded. He admits that there's very little money for new public housing, and the existing housing is perpetually underfinanced. At current funding levels, Price says, the DHA and other housing agencies don't have enough money to do what they need to do. In March, Scott shared his concerns about funding with Price's subcommittee, telling members, quote, we are now at a critical stage for needing aggressive action to undertake affordable housing production and preservation. A month earlier, the House Committee on Financial Services had received a memo calling for greater investment in affordable housing infrastructure, including the 1.1 million public housing units that are home to 2.6 million people. The memo pointed to a 2010 study commissioned by HUD that estimated that needed public housing repairs will cost $70 billion. And because the work isn't being done, housing authorities are losing 10,000 units a year. Price says the bill Trump signed in December set aside $45 million in grant funding for housing authorities to combat hazardous materials in their communities. He also points to the Emergency Capital Fund, which has about $30 million that can be used to address health and safety issues. These resources are relevant to the crisis at McDougal Terrace, says Price. We need to be pushing on both fronts. Lee Taus, our correspondent from the Raleigh area, breaking down barriers. A partnership between Wake County and Wake Tech aims to help residents climb the economic ladder. Unemployment in Wake County is among the lowest in the nation, 3%, but the county ranks 95 out of the 100 largest U.S. metros for economic mobility, meaning nearly everyone has a job, but few people are moving up in the ranks. Wake Works, a new partnership between Wake Tech and the county government, hopes to change that. The program, which offers tuition-free trade education through a salaried apprenticeship program, aims to not only help residents get a foot in the door, but also to take a step up the economic ladder. Commissioner Mark Calabria told the Indy, "We have folks who are working to make a better life for themselves and would benefit from additional job training, but may not be in a position to quit their jobs and go back to school when they have to support themselves or their families. This gives folks an opportunity to learn a trade, earn income while they're doing it, and ultimately make a better life for themselves." The Wake County Board of Commissioners unanimously agreed to contribute up to $500,000 to cover the cost of tuition, and that is $1,200 a semester for in-state students who take a full course schedule. Fees, books, tools, and uniforms for students enrolled in that program next fall. Wake Tech will cover at least $300,000 in startup costs and launch a marketing campaign. If enrollment exceeds capacity, Calabria says the program will seek additional funding through grants and private partnerships. Right now, Wake Tech has about 200 apprenticeships focusing on trades and manufacturing. Wake Works will add more than 300 more apprenticeships, expanding to include healthcare and hospitality. Apprentices will spend most of the program getting more than 2,000 hours of on-the-job experience in addition to 144 hours of classroom instruction. Starting salaries will be about $24 an hour, triple the North Carolina's minimum wage. The goal is removing barriers to education, said Wake Tech Vice President Matt Smith to county commissioners last week. We exist to make sure that anyone in Wake County that wants an education can get an education. Our enemy is barriers. Those barriers tend to be systemic, bolstered by racial, gender, and economic inequality. Commissioner James West pointed out the highest concentration of Wake Tech students lives in the 27610 zip code, which encompasses Southeast Raleigh. The problem, he said, is that the folks that normally need this support the most do not normally actively participate in our city process. To that end, Wake Works will try to actively recruit minorities and women who are underrepresented in the trades. Enrollment will be on a first-come, first-served, with no age limits. Consumers in the Triangle may also benefit, Calabria says, as there are critical labor shortages that are holding our businesses back. They are the people who build our houses, wire our offices, weld our machines, unclog our drains, Calabria says. If you don't have someone who can answer the phone when your air conditioning goes out and it's 95 degrees out this summer, you're going to be waiting for a while. And that rustling of pages is me skipping over the large insert about beer that I've promised to read as much as I can when the columns are finished. But here comes a glowing restaurant review from Nick Williams. This is from Jolie, 620 North Pearson Street in Raleigh. The escargot at Jolie isn't from around here. It's from planet Earth, obviously, but it doesn't taste like it's from here, Raleigh, North Carolina, North America. It doesn't taste like it was made in one of our kitchens by one of our chefs using our ingredients. This plate of escargot tastes like it is from France. From the first nanosecond, its Frenchness was singingly and triumphantly clear, even though I haven't been to France since I was 4 years old. Believe me, these snails are fluent en français. If dining out counts as an escape for most people, then a French restaurant is still the most effective place to stage a meal-based exodus from daily life. French cooking spent the late 20th century quietly surviving a wilderness of shifting culinary trends and emerged into the 21st, more beloved than ever, among the gastronomically minded American chef and diner. It's comfort food, but with roots that stretch back centuries, traversing empire and epoch. The food can be rich and hearty and luxurious, but also thoughtful, intellectual, with a suggestion of challenge and adventure. And this is what Jolie accomplishes with style and grace, the sense of wonder and joy behind the drilled application of technique and the resulting caloric onslaught that is French cooking. It's tricky to pinpoint what exactly imbues Jolie's escargot, which is in fact made in one of our kitchens by one of our chefs using our ingredients, with such an assertive identity. The suspension in which the escargot find themselves swimming, a concoction of pulverized anchovies and garlic, known as anchoyade, is certainly phenomenal. Maybe it's just the sheer amount of butter infusing every morsel. Maybe it's the gastropods themselves, briny, metallic, and sweet, and unfailingly, at least to me, exotic. More likely, this Gallic otherness is born from the mise-en-scene, which the setting is a vital component. Jolie is literally a corner bistro, nestled into an ever more fashionable stretch of Pearson Street in the Oakwood neighborhood. Inside, you find a narrow corridor in varying tones of off-white, subtly adorned with wood and burnished brass. A white marble bar and tabletops pull off the neat trick of being comfortable rather than clinical. Well-hidden soundproofing absorbs the voices of happy diners and allows the soundtrack, which is a decades-spanning mélange of French pop, to cut through the din. It's sexy, cozy, and inviting. Jolie is the newest venture from chef-owner Scott Crawford, whose outstanding Crawford and Son can be found a few doors down the block. The vision for Jolie is certainly Crawford's. The restaurant is named after his Francophile daughter, but he shares cooking duties with chef de cuisine and Raleigh native Madison Tessner. Tessner recently came home from gigs in Charleston and brought with her the easy finesse and appreciation for elegant decadence of that city's best restaurants. I begin with a mushroom tart, which tastes positively medieval, like something out of Le Viviendier de Talleyrand. A layer of molten brie binds a base of sweet pastry with a forest floor's worth of wild mushrooms, glazed with sherry and scattered with herbs. The sweetness of the pastry is initially disoriented next to the deep fungal earthiness of mushrooms, but the dish swiftly settles into profound ripeness. Louis XIV probably tucked into something similar, although I'll take the Jolie version with its accompanying salad of mustardy Mizuna greens. I don't think they grew those at Versailles. The beef bourguignon is similarly protean, here prepared with beef cheeks and fat little lardons. When I make beef bourguignon at home, its color can generously be described as brown. The Jolie version is a deep and tenebrous shade of chocolate, streaked with ruddy highlights from the namesake wine. It tastes, as one might imagine, like sex. And it shines. It shines like mirror glaze, like suckling pig, like General Tso's. Enrobed in glistening finery, the beef bourguignon is the most visually striking offering on a menu of beautifully plated creations. Our table quickly fills with visual artistry. The potato chips that accompany the duck roulettes are something of a technical marvel. Potatoes sliced into vellum thinness, then inlaid together and fried in duck fat. The resulting chip, really an enormous lacquered shard of crisp potato, is gorgeous, reminiscent of parquet floors or expert woodwork. Ours came out slightly burned and brought very little flavor beyond a lingering bitterness. The roulettes themselves, however, are light and airy with a lemony tang and a satisfying crunch of hazelnuts. It's a sophisticated approach to a rustic dish, and it ends up succeeding through ingredient minimalism. Beyond the plate ticket on a plate that is the escargot, the best dish on Jolie's menu is a simple bowl of mussels. If you come to Jolie hunting for rarer prey, you might overlook this ubiquitous bistro standard as it sits humbly amongst the soupes et salades. Skipping this dish, however, would be a grave mistake. The mussels are perfectly cooked, of course. They have the consistency of firm custard with the flavor of a seafaring marshmallow. But the ham broth in which the bivalves float is absolutely stupendous, bright, vivifying, bringing wave upon wave of smoke, salt, pork, and the essence of shellfish liqueur. The broth is perfect, ladies and gentlemen, and a welcome nod to local traditions and foodways. Let me close on a personal note. My first meal at Jolie coincided with the first moments that my wife and I had spent alone and out of the house since our second daughter was born in November. Taking full advantage of my employment-based requirement that I actually go out to eat, we plopped our children into their grandmother's lap and peeled away from our Durham home like we were fleeing a tsunami. We sought a literal escape. We took our time. We ordered enough food to cause our server considerable worry. We lingered over cocktails made with care and vermouth. We balanced the fat and sauce with an invigorating salad of citrus, pistou, and endive. We shared dessert, a caramelized apple gâteau in a pond of crème anglaise. We drank dry vouvray and enjoyed one another's simple there-ness. So, maybe it's the flush of romance talking. Maybe it's the fact that I got to spend 150 minutes calmly regarding the beautiful face of the person I love most in the world, shielded from the furious demands of a toddler and an infant. Maybe it was the company that conjured the most potent spell, but eating at Jolie certainly didn't hurt. All good restaurants provide an escape, one that truly transports is a more precious find. And right on our same page is three events, food-related events, I guess. Yes, they are, that are happening this week. Wednesday, that was yesterday through Sunday, at various prices, the Triangle Wine Experience. This snazzy charity event draws huge crowds every year and is the primary source of funding for Raleigh's Frankie Lemon School and Development Center. Events include a women's-only dinner cooked by Ashley Christensen, wine dinners, and the final black tie gala and auction, which will feature 70 wineries and 15 top local chefs. And these happen at various venues, trianglewineexperience.org, or this phone number, 919-821-7436. Over to Durham now for Saturday's Good Foods Awards North Carolina Showcase. Support farmers and makers at this afternoon event, showcasing the North Carolina winners and finalists of the annual Good Food Awards. Sip a beer and shop from a long queue of craft vendors, including Big Spoon Roasters, Haw River Mushrooms, and Two Chicks Farms. That's from 2 to 5. It's free to attend. and it is at Full Stream Brewery. They are on Rigsby Avenue in Durham. And on Sunday, February the 2nd, 3 p.m., the Waste Free Kitchen Workshop. If one of your New Year's goals was to have a more sustainable kitchen, this workshop is an actionable first step. Michelle Aronson of the Farm Belly Cooking School will instruct on ways to reduce disposable packaging, proper food storage, whole vegetable cooking, and do-it-yourself quick pickles. A ticket comes with an informational packet, a jar of pickles, and a drink from the pub. And this is a $40 fee, and it happens at the Eddy in Saxapahaw, on Saxapahaw Bethlehem Church Road. And if you want more information, the Eddy, TheEddyPub, theeddypub.com, or 336-525-2010 for the Waste-Free Kitchen Workshop on Sunday at 3 p.m. All right, I have some time for some arts columns by Martin Nunez Puzols. Techno-Utopia. With three outstanding new local techno releases and two shows to celebrate them, this is a big week for dance heads in the Triangle. Instead of a coincidence, this burst of activity speaks of the richness and incessant production of underground electronic music in our area. Active Analog is dropping Tributary, a double LP by Spongebath, at Nightlight on February 1st. The Charlotte-based techno label, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary, also promises an all-night dance party. Meanwhile, Hot Releases is launching two tapes, Binky's self-titled debut and dance floor veteran Faster Details Boombox, at a release show on February 3rd. The bill, a warm-up for that international noise conference in Miami, is rounded out by Raleigh's Sevra and two acts from New York City. It also takes place at Nightlight, which is known for its passionate efforts to support local artists while bringing world-class acts to the area. Hot Releases is one of the most active agents in the local experimental music field and is kicking off the year with four local releases. In addition to Binky and Faster Detail, there will be a newly mastered edition of Secret Boyfriend's Memory Care Unit and a tape of rhythmic trance-inducing noise by Sevra. At a vertiginous speed of 200 beats per minute, holy smokes, Binky taps into the characteristic overdriven kick sound of Gabber. The tape reinterprets and enriches this classic subgenre of hardcore techno, complicating the aggression of the fast kick with noise textures and psychedelic leanings. Now, parenthetic, I tell you that Curves, that high-energy exercise boutique, plays their jaw-dropping fast speeds, 140 beats per minute. 200, it's like, forget about jogging, you're sprinting on the dance floor. Anyway, the project is a collaboration of Durham's Aline Marie, also known as Liquid Asset, and Providence's Tom Bennett of Tinnitus Stimulus. The combination of their respective talents in hardware, acid techno, and harsh noise makes Binky a strange prodigy with a demented horror aesthetic that inspires euphoric dancing as much as unexpected chills. Faster Details Boombox has less dark, but just as frantic. Hot Releases founder, Ryan Martin, calls it 25 minutes of driving four on the floor cyborg rave-ups. Greensboro's Alex Chesney puts aside his more complex electronic experiments to offer one long track of warm, ultra-fun techno. The tape is delightfully simple, energetically over-the-top, and smoothed out by an extreme commitment to lo-fi. It was recorded live directly into a boombox. Since his arrival in Carrboro in 2008, SpongeBath's Nathan Taylor has been a constant presence in underground electronic events in the Triangle, both as a producer and a DJ. After three LPs, Tributary is his first double vinyl release. It contains seven tracks of hardware techno recorded over the span of 3 years in his home studio, dedicated to the memory of Taylor's grandfather and a tribute to the pioneers of underground dance music. Tributary is an exercise in gratitude for the people and artists that have shaped the producer, a reflection on what it means to be part of a tradition, and a successful attempt to keep it alive. Taylor says these tracks were designed to be used by DJs in a club. emphasizing the crucial role of the dance floor in the experience of techno. Throughout the tracks, we can hear echoes of the futuristic fantasies of Model 500, Drexia, and other Detroit trailblazers. There are also German dub influences, and we can sense the presence of more recent U.S. producers, such as Mike Parker and Bill Converse. When asked which aspects of classical underground dance music he cares about the most, Taylor replied, freedom, expression, escape, rebirth, struggle, but also, honestly, fun. This answer seems representative of the values of underground electronic music in our area. Even if the term underground can be divisive or merely refer to a particular aesthetic, its application to this community is meaningful. Their consistent efforts to keep the pleasure and liberation of electronic dance music free from market co-option, making music that exists for specific moments, spaces, places, outside of the constant onslaught of profit motive, as Taylor says, is a true act of resistance. As relentless technological mediation isolates us and reduces us to consumers, we have the privilege to live in a place where unconventional producers, labels, and venues are consciously creating conditions for electronic music to return us to our bodies and our communities. So writes Marta Nunez-Puzols. All right, we'll move over to a Sarah Edwards column in the Stage section. This is talking about a new drama called Orange Light, which is playing today through Sunday, February 16th at The Fruit in Durham. On September 3rd, 1991, a fire swept through an Imperial Foods chicken processing plant in Hamlet, North Carolina. There were no sprinklers or alarms in the buildings, and the emergency exits were locked from the outside, leaving workers without a way to escape. 25 people died, 56 were injured. The story received a flicker of national attention before receding into America's long history of preventable industrial tragedies. But it stuck with Durham playwright Howard L. Kraft. Orange Light, his new play, which runs at The Fruit with Bulldog Ensemble Theater January 30 to February 16th, is based on the tragedy. Kraft's plays often experiment with surreal structures. Freight, the five incarnations of Abel Green, which premiered in Chapel Hill before an off-Broadway New York run, is about an African-American man who exists in five different dimensions. But Kraft's plays always have a sturdy foothold in real life and in the struggles, injustices, and tragedies of our time. Previously, he's taken on the Vietnam War, his own experience in the military, a problematic comic strip, and the life of Nina Simone. This radical historical texturing both grounds and implicates audiences. Centered on the lives of five fictional women, Orange Light is directed by Joseph Nagel, a frequent Kraft collaborator, and features music by Reese Palmer. Ahead of the show, the Indie sat down with Kraft to talk about the Hamlet fire, working from primary texts, and how he chose to structure Orange Light. So this is an interview format article by Sarah Edwards. How long have you been working on the play? When I first got inspired about the story was actually around the time it happened, back in 91. I just remember it being so horrible. I couldn't get over the idea someone would lock the exit door to prevent people from stealing $2 chicken parts. Or at least that's why owner Emmett Rowe said he locked the doors. 25 people died and he only got 4 years. So it's been in your consciousness for a while. It's been knocking around and around. I'm still a poet, but I primarily write plays now, and I've transitioned into primarily being a playwright. I was trying to think about how I wanted to approach the story. I wanted it to be an all-women play. I wanted to emphasize the majority of the victims were single mothers. A lot of the men that could get out of the town got out because there's no work, just a chicken plant for $5 an hour, but if you have kids, you're stuck. Men also died and were injured because fire doesn't go by race or gender, but the impact on women just really stood out in my mind, and I wanted to shed light on the lives of the working poor, particularly women and children, who make up the largest percentage of the working poor. I want to ask about working with primary texts, oral histories, and court documents. Every artist in their approach to this kind of material is different. Some writers like to tell the exact story with the exact players, and what I do is more historical fiction. One reason I don't base it on those people is because those are people who have passed. Their own human story is so important, and I don't want to get it wrong. Bryant Simon was an important part of this process. He's a historian at Temple, and he wrote a book on the incident. I don't think incident is a good word. The murder. The murders. I had several opportunities to interview him, and all of that helped to formulate what I created. But I wanted to make it bigger than Hamlet, because I didn't want people to leave feeling, that was so sad, what a terrible one-off. It's not a one-off, and we are all complicit. There is a price you pay for chicken at Walmart, but we don't see the other side of it. Now a lot of that work is done by immigrant communities, the working conditions and exploitation, especially if those immigrants are undocumented, is even worse. You think about how these women were treated, and they were citizens. The play allows me to use this particular tragedy to look at some of the larger issues with how what we consume gets to us and sacrifices that are made so we can get, you know, the $2 chicken. We're coming up on the 30th anniversary of the fire. Do you think anything has changed? Hamlet was a unique situation because not only were there laws not in place, but the laws in place were not enforced, and they weren't enforced because, basically, I just call it what it is, Republicans cut the budget. Yep, there are better laws on the books, but are they being enforced? Every time we hear about something like this, the payout that the companies have to make is a drop in the bucket. Oftentimes it's cheaper to get caught and pay the fine than it is to follow the law. That was a decision that was made on a constant basis at Imperial Foods. The reason these people died at the end of the day is because he was too cheap to fix the cooker. Did you go to Hamlet while you were writing this? What's it like now? Depressing. I work with Mike Wiley, an actor and playwright, and we travel all over the state. He does one-man shows, and I do writing workshops off his shows for students. When you go down to the eastern part of the state, or even the western part, into those little towns, we always say, where do people work? There are no jobs. That's been the situation for decades. When I went to Hamlet, it's the same story. Most people work outside of Hamlet or in fast food places. The thing that stood out the most to me is that they have a museum there, which has all the history of Hamlet. But there's nothing about the fire. Not one piece. Now, if you walk around the corner, there's a very nice memorial for the victims. It has all the names and a little park. I guess maybe they said, that's enough. But if you don't walk around the corner, behind the railroad tracks, you won't see the memorial. If you don't know the story, before you come to Hamlet, you won't know the story. All right, I could move ahead to a dance, a lovely article about the Eve Project, but there's a lovely long article, a short mini reviews of local beers that I'm sure some of us want to read about, and I'll get to as many of these as I can in the little time I have remaining, and I will abridge this article to just list the names of the breweries and one of their standout products. So all of these columnists went to 48 breweries in Wake, Durham, and Orange counties. And we asked which of their beers best represented their work, their most popular, the brewer's favorite, or whatever, and dispatched our writers to go drink and write about it. So here's briefly what I can get across to us. Ancillary fermentation, and they chose Inside Out IPA. Ancillary is less standalone brewery than the product of Whit Baker's hyperactive mind and beer obsession. And Inside Out, a juicy IPA ancillary released at its 10th pop-up in December, is hazy, citrusy, packed with grapefruit notes, carries a hint of sweetness, and isn't weighed down by hoppiness. A pint goes down faster than you'd expect. Aviator Brewing. They choose, the haze is strong with this one. It's a tasty New England IPA with a complex hop profile, five varieties of hops used in just the right fashion. And it's a fragrant brew. The aroma hits your senses before the glass reaches your lips. That's immensely satisfying. Barrel Culture Brewing and Blending. I don't know if you know this, but I'm kind of a savage. And this is an extremely high alcohol, 11.5% ABV. Savage is a blend of two braggots, a mead beer hybrid made with both honey and barley fermented with microorganisms. And then, let's see, two braggots, honey and barley, I guess, that create complexity and deliberate sourness, then re-fermented on strawberries, vanilla, and Videri cocoa nibs. On the tongue, the experimental ingredients meld into a tart, dry, lightly honeyed, not sweet, potent sipping beer with a ghost of chocolate and berry and a finish sweetened by the vanilla. Big Bros Brewing Company features New Guy. Brewer Seth Adams wanted two representative Big Boss, so we had to choose for him. And let's see, Big Boy is a new guy and says, let's see, blah, 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 blah. I better read it all, huh? Best choice would be the New England IPA New Guy. Named after the new to the team Adams, though not by his choice, the New Guy was one of the first recipes and symbolizes the brewery's flexibility of what Big Boss can be. It wasn't known for its IPAs, located in Raleigh, but has a line of well-received ones. Along with the style's typical tropical fruit notes, New Guy also includes hints of mandarin orange and grapefruit. Big Boss Brewing Company. Bombshell Brewing, Lady in Red. Devin Singley makes four additions of three different hops while creating Lady in Red, a malt-forward, highly approachable American amber ale. Bombshells sees itself as a sort of gateway into the craft beer world, and it sees Lady as a beer that's complex enough to be interesting, but smooth enough for anyone to enjoy. There in Holly Springs. Bond Brothers Beer is in Cary. Bond Brothers brews a lot of beer and a lot of styles. We're featuring Flavor Patterns. Do yourself a favor and seek this out. It's a raspberry sour conditioned in the bottle on honey for something like 2 years, which turns the bright red of a fresh raspberry sour into something darker. On the nose, you feel like you walked into a raspberry field. On the tongue, it's mellower than you expect, yet still bright and delightfully tart. Botanist and Barrel Cidery and Winery features Skin Contact. Like all ciders, Skin Contact benefits from spontaneous fermentation, a process that foregoes controlled yeast strains and instead lets juice ferment naturally. After this initial fermentation of the apple-based cider, Skin Contact is re-fermented on cherry skins discarded from wine production. The rose-colored cider is unique and almost too drinkable. Dry and delicate, with plenty of fruit flavor and the aroma of a good cocktail cherry. Too drinkable. Maybe that refers to the 8% ABV. There in Cedar Grove. Blueprint Brewing Company. Blueprint Eric Wagner says the brewery is all about memories. They're featuring Zambrini. Zambrini is made to finish clean, balanced, and refreshing. Wagner says he's not wrong. The medium-bodied Zambrini pours clear with a slight malt aroma and drinks easy. Perfect. Even when the game goes to overtime. Over to Bull City Brewery, Burger and Brewery, and their selection, Henpeck Robust Porter, named for Henpeck Row, one of Durham's original streets. Robust Porter pours opaque brown-black with a tan head. Aroma, roasty and bready. After a sip, the beer drinker might suspect the brewers had added unsweetened black coffee, baker's chocolate, or cocoa nibs to the brew, but no. It just comes from roasted malt. And Bull City Cider Works. This is Taylor's Travels, 7% ABV. This one-off cider was made with two Southern Heritage apple varieties, Arkansas Black and Limbert Vig. I've not heard of those. And no adjunct flavors. It's fermented with wine, not beer yeast, then aged 8 months in a Pinot Noir barrel. It pours slightly hazy pale yellow with a faint pink tint. The aroma is sweet and vinous. The flavor is lightly tart and winey with a slight natural effervescence and no apple character or funk. Bull Durham Beer, Kolsch-style ale, housed in the Durham Bulls Athletic Park. The Kolsch-style combines a slight fruitiness of an ale with the crispness of a lager, sparkling, straw-colored with a tight white head, light yeasty, bready aroma, some sweetness, and a hint of spicy hops. Finishes with a welcome, lingering bitterness. Brewery Bavana, we've all heard of them. The Till Farmhouse Ale. Till tops their menu of always-on-tap core beers. Belgian-style saisons are Bavana's signature, and Till is its most essentialized saison, a reference point for the rest. Low alcohol, it's meant to be replenishing and quick-drinking, as saisons have been for centuries of Belgian farmhands on their lunch break. Carolina Brewery in Chapel Hill, Sky Blue Kolsch. Sick of IPAs but want something a little more interesting than lager? This traditional German-style craft beer might be your answer. Sky Blue Kolsch is bitter but crisp, with an initial fizz that disappears mid-sip. Clouds Brewing offers Midnight Delight. Co-founder John Oldendorf studied beer making in Munich, returning with a strict knowledge of Pilsners and Maybachs that formed the bedrock of Clouds Brewing, but Oldendorf and his company have found that deviating from German classics can also yield tasty and popular results. Midnight is a chocolate stout, might be their biggest hit yet, incorporating chocolate malts from dark brown barley, as well as actual cocoa nibs for a chocolate flavor that's sweet but not sugary. Oh, lots more to read. Will my voice hold out? Or my thirst? Compass Rose Brewery offers Tidal Wave. Hazy beers have had a cultish grip on the beer world lately, but traditional IPAs are making a comeback. Tidal Break, crisp, ultra-hoppy, and almost electrically bright. Piney, resinous, with rewarding citrus finish. And tastes like what being wide awake feels like. It's also award-winning. At last year's U.S. Open Beer Championship, it landed a bronze medal in the West Coast IPA category. And from Kerry, Cotton House Craft Brewery's Hazy Days. It's hardly your typical Vats and Brats brewery, and much like its locale, the popular Hazy Days is unique. Double dry-hopped hazy IPA that accounts for upward of 20% of its sales. The Craftborough Brewing Depot in Carrboro, new brewery, aims to honor craft beer traditions rather than reinvent the wheel. Unlike the many pale ales that veer into IPA territory with big hops, this one drinks like a smooth lager. Unbound is their choice. Gets its name for its fact that the type of hop used to make will rotate with each batch 4 to 5 times per year. The current iteration has hints of caramel without being malty and a mild flavor. Crank Arm Brewery with Road Hazard. Hazy IPA's can is covered in graphics of a winding road, littered with dangers, both real and fantastical. It's a refreshing one to enjoy after a long ride. Pineapple juicy and grassy, with a hoppy taste but only faint bitterness. Why feature it? Co-founder Adam Eckhart. All my children are special, just feeling the Road Hazard vibe right now. And the Dirty Bull Brewing Company from Durham. Barrel-aged Kandiru with a 12.8 ABV. The owner wanted to show off his barrel-aged sour, but it wouldn't be ready till after we went to print. So instead we got the Kandiru, a monster of a quad that spent 16 months resting in red wine and second-use bourbon barrels. The red wine note hits first, but quickly brushed aside by malt's subtle sweetness. A beer that should be served closer to room temperature than ice cold. A very fine example of the form. Faint Goat Brewing Company, Fainting Goat. This approachable Der Hoof, award-winning Hefeweizen, embodies Fainting Goat's focus on bringing people together. It's brewed with two kinds of hops, classical-style German Session beer that's light-bodied with only a hint of hops, bitterness, and a faint echo of cloves. Fortnight Brewing in Kerry offers an English breakfast stout. They pride themselves on using products that are as local as possible. The bourbon barrels the beer is aged in, as well as the cocoa nibs and coffee beans from Larry's Coffee in Raleigh, give the English breakfast stout in flavor. Its flavor are all sourced from North Carolina. It's a relaxing, slow drinker, a beer with enough smoothness and drinkability to belie its relatively high ABV, 9.5%. Oh boy, I think I'm going to make it. Let's see. We got the, yes, Fun Guys Brewing, the Smash Bandicoot, aggressively named, but it's accessible for most people. It's unusually, let's see, it's, they don't give it a type of brewing like an IPA. It, Smash will hold up to even the snobbiest of amber loyalists. Unusually deep red color would win a beauty contest. Just as malty and smooth, with just the right mild floral notes. Full Stream Brewery in Durham, Carver, a Vienna-style sweet potato lager. Gizmo Brew Works, Fake News. It's a juicy, low ABV New England style IPA. The Glass Jug Beer Lab, and that's in Durham. We tried raspberry pie, beet juice, pink, tart, and sweet, but cut with sea salt. Sourness steepening for a moment before shimmering away. Jordan Lake Brewing in Kerry, Orange Weissen. If we ever run out, riots ensue, says the self-described wearer of many hats, Cat Pierce. With a beer this light and airy, that goes down this smoothly, and that has a flavor profile this well-rounded, it's no wonder the Orange Weissen is one of Jordan Lake's tap staples. And Linwood Brewing Concern over in Raleigh on Whitaker Mill Road, Hop on Top was the first IPA brewed at Linwood Brewing, and the no-frills favorite is always on tap. It's there isn't anything terribly special about it. It's consistent, robust, and a great beer drinker's beer. Typical IPA, except there's nothing typical going on. Let's see. It's an active, happy mouthfeel and aroma with smooth finish and little to no aftertaste. And I didn't make it through. There were at least 20 more articles. To make it through, to get through that article on beers. And you'll just have to go to the Indie Week website and read something about them if you want to. And I see our musicians have trickled back into the studio. Trickled, and they're beginning to tune up again. And so I believe I have to stop this broadcast real soon. I'm John Federson. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service, formerly now North Carolina Reading Service, and the program is intended for blind and print-impaired audience. It will be available as a podcast on our website following the initial broadcast. And I hope I've mentioned everything I need to mention, and we wish you a nice weekend, and we hope to see you on the next week's issue. Thanks, and so long.